Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi, everyone. We have two incredible guests today who I'm super, super excited to interview together. The first is a fantasy romance author and book talker with a propensity for villains. Dun, dun, dun. When she's not creating bookish comedy skits about villains and assistants, she's writing to Taylor Swift's songs. Her biggest passions in life include romance, magic, laughter, and finding ways to include them in everything she creates. Most days you can find her with her head in the clouds and a pen in her hand. It's my pleasure to welcome number one New York Times best-selling author, Hannah Nicole Mayer. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here with Brent, too.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you. So here are your books that I have. I got the large font edition for Assistant to the Villain because I'm half blind, and this was awesome. And here's the second one, which I'll read the flap copy to as well. Listeners can't see, but I'm holding up all the book covers because these books are just so damn fun, and these covers are just so damn fun. But we will get to that, Hannah. Right, so now I'm going to introduce our second guest. It is her agent, Brent Taylor, who is a senior literary agent at Triada US. He joined the agency in 2014 as an 18-year-old summer intern. His clients' books have hit the bestseller lists, won major awards, and garnered dozens of starred reviews. You can find him online at btaylorbooks.com. Welcome, Brent.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you here. I love chatting with agents. This industry is so subjective. And what I love is generally what one agent says completely contradicts what another agent says, which shows how clear as mud publishing is, which makes it a bit easier for the rest of us to deal with it. Right. So before we dive into these, and I've got many, many questions. Before we dive in, I just want to tell our listeners that Hannah's latest book, Apprentice to the Villain, is a sequel to her debut, Assistant to the Villain. Now, I'm just going to read you the flap copy, and we will link to this on our bookshop.org affiliate page, where you can buy the book there and support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Evie Sage has never been happier to be the assistant to the villain. Who would have thought that working for an outrageously handsome, it's bad for his brand,
evil overlord would be so rewarding. Still, the business of being bad is demanding, the forces of good are annoyingly persistent, and said forbidding boss is somewhat out of evil office. But Renadorn is in grave trouble, and all signs point to catastrophe. Something peculiar is happening with the kingdom's magic, and it's made the villain's manor vulnerable to their enemies, including their nemesis, the king. Now it's time for Evie to face her greatest challenge, protecting the villain's lair, all of his nefarious works, and maybe, provided no one finds out, the entire kingdom. No pressure, Evie. It's time to step out of her comfort zone and learn new skills, like treason, dagger work, conspiring with the enemy. It's all so, so delightfully fun. But what happens when the assistant to the villain is ready to become his apprentice? Right, so Hannah, to kick us off, just to give us some context here, your debut was inspired by a series of TikTok skits that you did. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about that? Because writers keep getting told to get onto TikTok as a platform, and most of us as writers find this excruciating in terms of coming up with content that isn't a natural setting. So I love hearing about a book that was inspired by skits on TikTok.
Yeah, so it was kind of fortuitous. It wasn't like purposeful that it ended up turning into a book series. And I think that that's what made it so uniquely special. I had been doing skits on TikTok for a couple of months, and I have been writing forever. I love telling stories. I'm a very creative person. So this was just really another creative outlet for me to make content and make stories. And I started doing the assistant to the villain skits in 2021. I don't even know. I think that was the year. It feels so like yesterday. But yeah, I started doing them in the summer. And I remember posting the first video, and I was at my nanny job. I put my phone down, like I picked it up, posted, put it down. And then I got the twins down for their nap. And when I picked up my phone again to look at my phone, it was like all of these comments and all of these people that loved the story. And I also loved it so much. So I kept making them. And I was writing something else at the time and just not enjoying it as much as I did enjoy making the skits. And then eventually it turned into like storylines, and the characters actually felt like tangible. And eventually I had to write it all down, or I was going to go bonkers, because it just felt like it was constantly in my head. And yeah, and so I started writing the book. And because I had built a really supportive, loving community on TikTok along with the story, I got to post about writing the book and sharing excerpts of the book along the way. So it was really, really cool, because everyone that had followed along with the skits was now following along with the book's journey as well. So it was really, honestly, it was almost an accident that it ended up being so awesome.
That's incredible. And you can see how much fun you have. You know, I watch you and I start giggling every single time, because, you know, you just are clearly having so much fun. And every time I have to create content for Instagram, I think I was on TikTok for like 3 months when my last book came out. And I was just, oh my God, I'm hating this. So also for our listeners, it's a sign that if a platform isn't for you, it's not for you. But if you are like Hannah and you've got this exuberance and this playfulness that just naturally leads itself to this platform, have fun on it. Don't take it quite so seriously, because you don't actually know where it's going to go. One last question, Hannah, before we get into you and Brent and how you work together and your journey together. You know, in your bio, you call yourself a fantasy romance author. Now, for our listeners who are trying to find their genre when they're pitching agents, are we saying fantasy romance? Are we saying romantasy? How are we separating these two?
So I feel like the romantasy as a genre is like just become like on the rise in the last, I wouldn't even say the last year really exploded in the last 2 years. So when I was querying and when Brent reached out to me, I feel when I first started talking about the book in 2021, I don't know that the word romantasy was coined yet, or if it had been, it wasn't like mainstream enough yet, that word, for me to say it in videos. So when I say romance fantasy, it's definitely romantasy in my mind. And I think that it can be dependent. I don't actually know the hard and fast definitions or the difference between the two things, but I would definitely say romantasy is fulfilling a need that's been there for a really long time. There's so many people that love fantasy, and the thing they love about a fantasy book is the romance intertwined. So this is just kind of a way to propel the romance along with the fantasy aspect. So I think that it's so great. And I think it's a reason that it's picking up so much popularity. And I truly think that it's only going to keep soaring in popularity. So I think when querying, if you feel your book is a romanticy, and Brent might know this from an agent perspective, but from a author perspective and from a reader perspective, I think pitching a book as a romanticy is always a good idea.
Yeah, it is a genre that is doing incredibly, incredibly well. Okay, so Brent, how did you discover Hannah? Was it through the popularity of the TikTok skits that you became a fan of and you reached out to her, or did she actually query you?
I had an intern at the time who was reading manuscripts for me, and we had a weekly meeting. And during one of those meetings, my intern said to me, you know, I follow this girl on TikTok and she does these skits about an assistant to the villain and I love them. And she just made a post that she wrote a manuscript and, you know, I'm dying to read it. I really want to read it. And so my intern was encouraging me to reach out to Hannah to ask to read the manuscript. I think secretly my intern just had, you know, a motive of just wanting to get their hands on this and to have the chance to read it. So what I did was later that day, I went to Hannah's TikTok page and I absolutely loved the skits. I thought they were amazing and I could totally see how they would lend themselves really well to a book, because I just felt like Hannah's voice, her comedic voice, was really shining through in those TikToks. And there was also so much plot and character development in those TikToks. So I emailed Hannah and I introduced myself and I said that if she ever wanted to take her manuscript and pursue traditional publishing, that I would love to consider it. So Hannah sent it to me and I read it and loved it. The intern read it and loved it. So that summer I offered representation to Hannah and we started working together on edits to the manuscript.
Oh, I love that so much. So it sounds like your intern is a bit diabolical, that they wanted to get their hands on something before anybody else. So maybe, Hannah, you do an intern to the villain. I really, really love that. Hannah, was Brent the only agent who reached out? I must imagine that because of your platform, there were other agents who were like, this is going to be great. How did that process look for you? Or was it just Brent?
So I got advice. I'm very lucky that I have friends that have traditionally published. So they were able to give me lots of advice. They told me like what questions to ask agents and things like that. So I did traditional query. Brent was the first person I sent the manuscript to because he was the first person to reach out to me. And I was so excited. I like couldn't believe it. And I even asked one of my friends about the agency and she had like nothing but amazing things to say about the agency as a whole. And yeah, so I already had like such good feelings about sending the manuscript to Brent. But then I also traditionally queried because I just felt like it was smart to send out a bunch of different query letters. And then I did have interest from one other agent. And I remember I got on the phone with her and she was lovely. She was also so excited about the book. I remember I got on the phone with her the day before. I told Brent that I wanted to work with him the following day. And it wasn't because the other agent wasn't so wonderful. It was just because I felt like Brent just understood where the story came from. He was sort of the first person to make me feel like someone believes in this story as much as I do. And he always matched my excitement. And I just felt like we were going to work really well together. So I ended up going with Brent the very next day. I had no doubt in my mind that that was the right decision. And I've been nothing but pleased since then. So I'm very lucky to work with someone so encouraging and awesome.
Chemistry is so important in an agent-author relationship. You know, I often say on the podcast, it's like a marriage, right? Because you don't want to just write and publish one book. You want a whole career. And so the person that you are with in terms of this career needs to get what you're trying to do, be your biggest champion, but you need to be able to communicate very well, because things aren't always going to go well. There'll be times that Brent has to tell you bad news. Maybe there was something you were hoping for. And I know your career has been incredible, Hannah. It's the kind of career that most debut authors drool over. But there still will be times that there are negative things. And so, yeah, that agent chemistry is so important. Before I ask my next question of the both of you, so Hannah, when you traditionally queried, what the heck were you comping to? What titles were you comparing your book to? Because it's so refreshingly different. So what were you saying? Okay, put it on the bookshelf next to this and this.
Oh my gosh, I'm trying to remember. I like need to pull up my old query letter because I don't even remember. And I tailored each one to different agents, which I think is like what they recommend you do. You tailor them to each agent that you're querying to. I'm trying to remember. I think that I've always kind of comped it as like a Shrek vibed book. But it was hard actually to comp it because I felt like there wasn't a whole lot of books to compare it to because it was so tonally unique. Like it had elements for sure of books that are already out there and absolutely amazing. But it was a little bit of a struggle, I think, because tone wise, it's a little unique. And now we're really seeing like the rise of cozy fantasy, which is so awesome because that's my favorite thing to read. Yeah, I had difficulties, I think, comping it. I'm trying to remember if I comped it anything, it would probably be the Princess Bride, and that tone wise, very witty tongue in cheek banter with romance and some grounding moments too. So yeah, I feel like comping it was a little tough, but it was interesting for sure.
Yeah, I mean, as writers, you want to write something that's really different, that there aren't a ton of books like that in the marketplace, but then it is difficult to say it's going to sit next to the shelf with this and this, you know. So it is fantasy, it is romance, but a lot of romantasy books are, like you say, completely tonally different. And this book is laugh out loud, hilariously funny. I mean, I was reading it next to my husband and I'd burst out laughing and he'd be like, okay, so what is happening now? What are you laughing at? And eventually, instead of reading the lines aloud, I was like, you can read it after me. You know, you can read it after me. And he loved it too. And he's a dude who normally just wants to do Game of Thrones and Dragons, but he thought it was hilarious as well. So such a big market for this. So Brent, once you signed with Hannah, was it a case of working together to do edits, to polish it before you sent it out? Or was it a case of this was really polished and you were like, we are good to go? What did that process look like?
Yes, I really fell in love with the manuscript. So, you know, the manuscript definitely had an amazing, you know, beating heart, but we wanted to make the book as strong as possible before sending it out to publishers. So we just did one round of relatively minor revision, if I'm remembering correctly. Yeah, so it was just, I think, a few weeks of revision, and then we sent it out to publishers. So nothing major, but just polishing it up to position us for success.
Wonderful. Hannah, was that the first time you were getting feedback on the manuscript in terms of revising, or did you have beta readers or writing friends who were reading the book as you were going along?
So I did send it to a couple of friends that are authors or writers just to like get opinions, but this was the first like editorial feedback I got, because mostly when you send it to your close friends, the responses are like, oh my God, I'm giggling so much at this part, which is also so fun and like gratifying as an author. But yeah, this was my first time getting like official editorial notes. And I was nervous at first just because I'd never gotten editorial notes. But as soon as I saw them, I was so excited because I love going into edit. I'll have like a day where I really think about all of the edit notes. And then I get excited because it gives me a million ideas of how to intertwine those edits within the story. And Brent gave me like amazing notes, things that are so intrinsic to the story now that weren't in the first draft of the story. And that just made it so much better. And everything that he suggested just elevated the book. So it just made it was still like the same book that I wrote. It just elevated it to a different level that definitely positioned it for a lot of success. So I'm very fortunate.
Yeah, I love what you've said there. And two things. I think it's important for writers out there to have the one cheerleading reader, the one person who goes, I've read it, I loved it, it's hilarious, it's perfect, because we need that as writers to make us go, okay, this is what I'm working on is good, I can continue. But then we need our tough love reader, the person who's going to go, it's great, it's really great, but this is how we can make it better. And I'm sure, Hannah, the challenge with taking a bunch of skits and turning them into a novel is the connective tissue, right? Because you have the dramatized moments in the skit, but there needs to be interiority and setting, because you're doing a skit in, you know, your bedroom, in your home, but now suddenly you have to describe what the setting looks like, what this world looks like in terms of that world building. And so there's a lot of connective tissue that has to come in. And I know I read an interview in which you said dialogue comes easy to you because of the skits. So did you find setting particularly to be a challenge when you sat down to write it? Or was this world so vivid in your mind that even though you didn't have big sets behind you during the skits, you knew exactly what everything looked like?
So I, again, I'm lucky in that respect because I had been doing these skits. I feel like I started writing the book. I started doing the skits in June of 2021. And then I started writing the book in, I think, late September, early October. So I had a couple months under my belt of making these skits, and this story was, again, living in my head like so aggressively for so long before I actually sat down to write it. So I was lucky in that respect, because I think if I had sat down to write it even a month in, I probably would have struggled more with setting and more with background and more with like the characters' voices and stuff. But because I had been doing it for so long, I felt like I know this story. I know what it looks like. I know what these characters would say here and here and here. Like, I knew them well enough by the time I sat down, and I knew the landscape, so to speak, well enough when I sat down to write it. It wasn't terribly difficult because I have a very vivid imagination. And again, I'm lucky in that regard, but I think I definitely would have had more difficulty doing it had I started writing the book a month in or even 2 months in. I had nice groundwork to like really think about what this would look like. And I was always thinking about it. So definitely like a lot of build up to it when I sat down to write it. So that was an advantage for sure.
It's a kind of method acting writing, you know, where you become the character to really get to know the character. And we've had other authors before on the show who've spoken about this. And in one of our recent deep dives, we also had an author who went through putting yourself in the character's shoes and going out into the world and acting like this character and seeing how people respond to it. Because, you know, this is how you vividly bring a character to life. Right. So Brent, when you went out on submission with this book, what was your submission strategies in terms of which publishers you sent this book to? Because it's so different and because it's so unusual, I don't suppose that there were editors that you were like, well, they've bought similar books before, so I absolutely know they're going to like it. How do you approach sending a book like this out on submission?
Yes. So I work very collaboratively with my clients when it comes to developing that list of editors that we want to submit the book to. So I did talk with Hannah, and we both felt that we could see the book either being published as YA or being published as adult. So we did go to both young adult editors and adult editors at the same time. And we primarily targeted the big major publishers. I tried to go after the editors who did fantasy, but also kind of did more comedic light books. And so I just went to a mix of different types of editors. I also like to be open-minded, and I like to go to more junior editors in addition to, you know, very senior editors, just to diversify that list. So I sent it out, and then it was just a lot of waiting to hear back from people.
I love that you said junior editors as well. And for our listeners, you know, as well, when you're querying agents, query junior agents. And when the time comes later, query junior editors, because they are trying really hard to make their mark, to prove themselves. And so they will champion your work in ways that a very senior agent or editor who's had tons of success may not throw themselves into it with that kind of passion. So I love that you did that. In terms of the comps, what the heck were you comping to, Brent? Did you carry on with the Shrek and the Princess Bride thing? What were you doing there? And was the query trying to capture the voiciness of the novel, or was it more a sort of traditional submission in terms of that tone?
Yes, I love that question. I think that, you know, we were really trying to sell this book at a time when there really wasn't anything out there like this in the market. You know, nowadays I can sell cozy fantasy or cozy romanticy super easily. And I comp to Assistant to the Villain. I tell editors, this is perfect for Assistant to the Villain. And I'm credible when I say that because I represented Assistant to the Villain. So, you know, nowadays it's so easy for me to sell cozy romanticy. I love selling it. I have a wealth of comps to use. Back then, we really had nothing. So it was very challenging. And as much as Hannah kind of struggled to think of comps, I really struggled as well. So I think when we were presenting this book to publishers, it was more about just emphasizing the uniqueness of the concept of, you know, there is an assistant to this evil villain and, you know, it's this fairy tale world. I think that's what got people intrigued. And then I knew that once they started to read the manuscript, that they would then kind of fall in love with that comedic voice. But Yeah, I wish that I had comps to use, but I think it's, you know, a testament to Hannah that she really helped define this genre.
I love that you are both trailblazers. You know, Hannah, you couldn't find comps, and now your book is being held up as this perfect example of a comp. And I absolutely love that. I love it when writers and agents and editors are prepared to forge new territory as opposed to always going, well, this is what's traditionally worked in the past. So that's incredible. Last question for you, Brent, for now, before I go over to Hannah again, is in terms of, were there a lot of rejections from editors who are now beating themselves up? Because our listeners love hearing about agents and editors who said no and who went on to regret it for all eternity. You don't have to give us names, but you can spill a bit of tea.
Yes, absolutely. You know, Hannah and I, we truly endured our fair share of rejections for this book. I think because we did pitch it at a time when cozy fantasy wasn't as hot as it is now. So we had a lot of editors just say that they couldn't see how to publish this book. And I do have editors that have said to me, like, wow, I really was wrong. You know, this book, you all proved that there was a market for it. So I've had at least two editors say that to me. And yeah, it's just one of those things that it's really difficult to deal with rejection as you're receiving them. But you have to have hope, you know, that one day you'll be kind of looking back on that experience fondly.
Yeah, when I hear that, I just want to do like an evil villain laugh, like, mwahahaha, because it's awesome when they're like, we were wrong, we're sorry, we should have seen the vision. And that's always incredibly encouraging. So Hannah, when you went out on submission with Brent, here's the thing that I always struggled with in terms of every time I've gone out on submission is you want to protect your mental health, because there'll be days that you will hear about 5 rejections in one day. And that's a lot. And sometimes I remember I was on vacation once for a week. We had been waiting for weeks to hear anything. And suddenly 5 rejections came through while I was on vacation, lying on a beach with a cocktail. And it was a lot. But I'm such a control freak that I want to know every time a rejection comes in and what the rejection is, if it's something that I can use. And that process is very different for every author. So how did you ask Brent to work with you while you were on submission?
I'm trying to remember, but Brent is always up for whatever's like going to be most comfortable. So I think I wanted to know when I got rejected. And I think there were times when I didn't. I feel like we did a little of both. Like sometimes I did know and I knew the reason, and sometimes I didn't know and I didn't know the reason. And that was always for the best. So I kind of really trusted Brent to take care of me in that regard. And he totally did. There were times that I'd get a rejection and it would send me into like a tailspin. But I'm lucky again with Brent, because I would message him in a tizzy and be like, ah, like panicking. And then immediately would get a call from him. And by the end of the call, I like forgot that I was upset at the beginning of the call because I'm so excited at the end of the call. He's very good at spinning like a negative into a positive, which is something I am naturally inclined to do. So it works really well for me. And yeah, I think that it's rejections like really difficult. I do think it was good for me to do that part of the process because it helped season me a little bit. And yeah, we ended up in a great situation. So it ended up working out for the best.
Like a fairy tale book, it had its happy ending, which is amazing. So Brent, for our listeners out there, when they are busy deciding on an agent, because I always say it just takes one yes, which is true, but the one person who's saying yes may not be the best fit for you. So for example, for me, my agent is my second agent, and she's excellent editorially. And that's really what I wanted. Besides her being an excellent agent, I wanted someone who was really good editorially. And she's like you in that her style with every one of her clients is completely different, because she gives each of them what they want and what they need. Some people need more hand holding. Some people are like, don't hold my hand. Some people need micromanaging in terms of deadlines. And other people are like, I've got this. So for you, when the time comes for an emerging author to have that conversation with the agent, like what kind of things should they be asking? And what kind of needs should they be expressing to make sure that it is a good fit?
Yes, I love that question. I would encourage authors to ask agents, you know, what their favorite parts of the job are. Because you may hear an agent say, I love the editorial piece of this. And then the business side of things, I don't love that as much. Or you would hear the exact opposite, or perhaps somewhere in the middle. You know, each agent has a totally different vision and style. And I think, you know, you learn a lot about someone by hearing what they're passionate about and what their strengths are. And then you could also ask, what are your least favorite parts of this job? And that would also kind of illuminate to you, you know, the elements of the business that the agent doesn't necessarily value as much as the other pieces that they're more passionate about. And I think that would help you ascertain, you know, if that agent's strengths and weaknesses align with what you are looking for as an author.
Excellent, excellent answer. I absolutely love that. And it's so important for that chemistry to be right. And I think, like a good relationship, communication is essential. So for writers out there, ask the questions, communicate your needs. If you're someone who needs handholding, don't say, oh, I don't need handholding. And then when the time comes, you're feeling like your agent has just kind of left you hanging and you don't feel like you have that connection. So I think honesty and transparency is so, so important in that relationship. Now, Hannah, question to you. In terms of platform, we're always hearing as writers, you need a big platform, et cetera, et cetera. Do you feel like your platform translated to actual book sales? I'm thinking yes, because people love this villainous character so much and the assistant character so much, Evie, in the skits, that it would have translated to sales. How did you experience that once the book actually came out? Or even before that, did you get a ton of pre-orders from people who were just so excited that this book was finally coming into the world?
I always think that you definitely don't, because at least from what I've observed of the industry, you don't need a huge platform to be traditionally published. The benefit of it is it exposes you to the readers that would be interested in your story. And I was, again, really privileged in that regard because I had been doing these skits for so long and I had built up an audience that loved this story just as much as I did. So I definitely think that there was already like a core group of people that were interested in Assistant to the Villain and were interested in ordering it. And I also think that there's people that had never seen the skits that I will say, they'll come on and be like, I'm watching the skits now because I've read the book and I didn't know they came from skits, which is super cool to see like it coming from a different perspective, because for so long I was assuming that people that were first ordering it were people that knew my story, knew about the skits, were fans of the skits, were excited about seeing it translated into a book form. So yeah, I definitely think that it helped me find the audience for this specific genre and for the specific tone of how I write. And it's definitely a huge privilege to have a platform to get you that exposure. But yeah, I think it definitely translated, I think, into sales. And then I think that even from an outside perspective, I've had people come to my page and find me just from finding my book in a store. Now they like the skits on social media and it's kind of like reversing, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's how I found you on socials. I had loved the book and then I was like, let me follow the author. And then I was like, oh, look at all this amazing content. So yeah, it does go both ways. So Brent, this question's for you. Did you pitch this originally as a series? Was it that you and Hannah had said, this can go on? Did you try and sell it as a 2-book deal? How did that look for you?
Yes, we envisioned it as a series from the very beginning. And we were very lucky that when we did end up selling the rights to Entangled for their Red Tower Books imprint, that Entangled saw it as a series as well. And they wanted to, you know, invest in it as a series from the very beginning.
And Hannah, how did that process look for you then if you were writing to a deadline the second time, whereas the first time you were not writing to a deadline? Because with my first book, I was like 3 years, la, 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 la. And second book, I was like, holy shit, I need to get this done in 6 months. It was a very different thing for me. So how was that for you?
So my first experience with the deadline before that, and it was very like light deadline because Brent and I were like pretty flexible with it. And if I asked for another week, he would have given me another week. But yeah, it was different for sure being on like, this is the date we need the book by, because it was balancing it sort of with like other things in my personal life. And then at the time I was still working a second job. So the balance of it all was a juggling act for a period of time for sure. I think I wrote it in about the same amount of time that I wrote Assistant to the Villain. I had a lot of motivation writing the first one because again, I was sharing it on social media. I was feeling like a lot of encouragement, and that always makes it easier to sit down and be excited about the things you're writing when there's lots of other people that are excited about it too. I'm lucky in that my editor and my editorial team gave me a decent chunk of time to get the book done. And that even if there were times, like I'd remember for my second deadline, they had come back and asked for a date. And I truly was like, there's no way I can get that back to them in the way that I want to do it by that date. And I told them that, and they were very good about giving me the time that I needed, which I don't know that that's always the case. It was definitely different. I learned a lot about time management the second time around, but I feel a lot more confident going into book three. So I'm glad I had like that little bump at the beginning, learning to juggle it, because now going into book three, I'm very confident about how to, you know, bide my time with social media, juggling that with drafting, and then, you know, traveling and things outside of the book world. Yeah, it was definitely a juggling act for sure at the beginning, but it got easier the more I did it.
And, you know, Brent, so as Hannah's agent, you're also the person who runs interference for her. If something happens in her life, unforeseen circumstances, some kind of a hiccup, she's not going to be able to deliver the manuscript on time. You know, you're the person who then goes to bat for her and negotiates an extension of deadlines, etc. Can you speak a bit about that as well?
Yes. I mean, it does really depend on the author and their relationship with that publisher. You know, the relationship Hannah has with Entangled is very collaborative. Because they are a smaller independent house, they operate a little differently from the big five publishers. So at a big five publishing house, you know, you're primarily just communicating with the editor. At Entangled, Hannah talks to everyone. She speaks directly to the marketing people, directly to the publicity people. And so in that situation, you know, Hannah is kind of empowered to just to collaborate with Entangled to, you know, find the dates and the things that work. But it just depends on the publishing relationship.
Thank you so much. And now last question. So for our listeners, you know, when we have our co-host Carly and Cece on the show and we read query letters to give you critique so that you can send very polished query letters to agents, we 9 times out of 10 say cut the prologue. The prologue is just a band-aid. It doesn't need to be there. And we generally say, if you're going to have a prologue, keep it short. You are going to be thrilled to know that Assistant to the Villain has got one of the longest prologues I have ever read in my life. In fact, when I got to chapter one and it said chapter one, I was like, what the actual? I was like, was that a prologue that I just read? And it worked. It worked as a long prologue. So Hannah, can you take us through the decision for the prologue? Was it there all along? Was it something that you added afterwards? And just give our readers that boost to know that if they really feel the damn prologue is necessary, it is necessary.
So it's funny because in the original, and Brent knows this, in the original draft, the first draft of Assistant to the Villain, there was like an aggressive amount of flashbacks, like enough that they were slowing the pace of the story in a way that was not working. And it too, a lot of the flashbacks were things that could have just been information shared throughout the story and kind of more of a way. And the way my editor described it was really good for my brain. She was like, it's like you're shining a flashlight in a dark room and you're backing up slowly with it throughout the story. So you get more and more and more of it. But the one flashback, so I was fine cutting a lot of the flashbacks. The one I didn't want to lose was Evie and the villain's first meeting. Cause I was like, this is so important. I can't cut this. And I love, it was kind of the first scene in the book that I felt really strongly about. So I'm trying to think, I think it was originally in like one of the early chapters. It wasn't chapter one. It wasn't a prologue. It was maybe chapter like 2 to 5, somewhere in there was the flashback of their first meeting. And then my editor team was in agreement. They were like, no, we can't cut this because it is a great scene and it kind of intros them. And then I forget which one on the team, but somebody was like, what if we make it the prologue? And it's the first thing you read because it's also like so fun and kind of draws you into the story. So I won't take any credit for that. That was my amazing editorial team had the suggestion. And I loved the idea because it was one of my favorite scenes. So the idea of the reader seeing that first was like such a great idea. So yeah, it wasn't originally the prologue when we sold them the book, but it ended up being the prologue. And it worked out really nicely, I think.
I'm so glad it was there. It needed to be there. It was excellent. So for our listeners, I know 9 times out of 10, we say cut the prologue. This is one of them where it really needed to be there and it just elevated the story and it set the tone and it was awesome. Last question, Hannah, is Your book is one of the first books that I saw with trigger warnings or content warnings at the beginning, which was really awesome because there's parts of this book that, I mean, as hilarious as it is, there are some really gruesome things, you know, and I think it's important to kind of prepare the reader for that. And I feel like bookstagrammers and book bloggers will give content or trigger warnings, but you're not really seeing them at the beginning of books. So how important was that to you? Was that always there? Was that a conversation you had to have with the publisher?
So again, I'm really lucky in that regard and that my publisher definitely, I think, puts an emphasis on having the trigger warnings there for the reader. So they actually approached me with it towards the end of the publishing process. And I was like, absolutely, definitely. They worked it out and helped like find everything in there that should be mentioned at the beginning, which I think for Assistant to the Villain particularly is important because if you look at the cover and you read the back of the book, and it is very fun and tongue-in-cheek and silly, and there's so many silly scenes, but I think that I wouldn't want it to mislead someone into thinking there's no like hard and fast grounding moments to the story where there's some serious themes discussed. And the playful banter is there the entire time, but those things are discussed and that way, and it's at the front of the book and that way it gives someone the choice to read them or not. And some people might prefer not to read the trigger warnings, but if they do, it's there as an option. But that was my amazing publisher came to me with it first and I was able to be like, yes, absolutely. So it was definitely important to me that it was there and I'm glad that it is for Apprentice to the Villain as well.
Wonderful. Well, Brent and Hannah, thank you so much for this incredible interview. It's so wonderful to get to speak to an agent with the author, see how they work together, get advice as inspiration for everybody else out there. We really, really appreciate the time you've taken and can't wait for the third book.
Thank you so much for having us both on. It was so fun.
Thank you so much.
Working in a creative industry, I've seen lots of writers and illustrators feel squeamish around money conversations. As a literary agent, I love talking about money, and that's why debunking money conversations are so important. Like, many people think you need loads of money to start investing, or they put off investing because it seems like a later problem. Or creators who deal with art and writing don't have time or passion to research and manage something like investments. That's why I'm thrilled that today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Growing up as a young girl who was told she wasn't good at math, investing definitely scared me, but I'm proud to say that I've overcome all those mindset concerns and love talking about investing and how money can be given a chance to grow over time with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/TSNOTYAW or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important information disclosures at acorns.com/TSNOTYAW. After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app. And it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them. And that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then with phrases and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Chitno Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Hello, listeners. So today we don't just have an interview. We have a life-changing moment for myself, Cece. Today, I have peaked. I can't go higher than this. I can't interview someone whose work I love more. It would not be humanly possible because such a person does not exist. I am here with the number one New York Times best-selling author of Big Little Lies, Apples Never Fall, The Husband's Secret, Truly Madly Guilty, New York Times bestseller, Nine Perfect Strangers, What Alice Forgot, The Last Anniversary, as well as the amazing novels, The Hypnotist's Love Story and Three Wishes. I cannot believe I'm saying these words, but please join me in welcoming the one, the only, the storytelling sensation and publishing legend, Leon Moriarty. Welcome, Leon.
Oh, thank you so much, Susie. That's the loveliest introduction ever.
I am seriously having a very, very emotional moment because I am a huge fan of your work, but I am going to remember that I'm here to do a service to our listeners. Listeners, this is all about you. And so I'm going to ask you questions and not get super emotional, but truly, I want to thank you for the beautiful books you write. They mean a lot to me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. That makes me emotional. Thank you.
So let's talk about the premise of your novel. So a woman in her 70s, and this is not someone who would call attention in any way, gets up in the middle of a flight and she walks down the aisle and she points to each passenger and announces their cause of death, age of death. Things like workplace accident, age 43, disease of the urinary system, age 92. She even does it to children and to a baby who's on the plane. And people react like you'd expect them to in different ways. Some take it seriously, some do not, but everyone starts having really big reactions when her predictions start coming true. One, two, three people die exactly as she predicted. Will there be a fourth death? Who is this woman? And how will the lives of these passengers on this plane be fundamentally altered by this very unusual incident? So that's the premise. And my first question to you is, how'd you come up with the story? Was it when you were on a plane?
It was actually, yes. So I was on a plane coming out of Hobart, which is exactly where the fictional flight takes place, Hobart in Tasmania, which is the little island at the bottom of Australia, which often gets left off the map. And I was on the plane without a book, which is always a mistake. Never travel without a book. Although in this case, it did end up giving me a premise for a novel. So what happened was I was sitting there and, as I say, the plane was stuck on the tarmac. So, you know, it's sort of going a little bit crazy. And the cheerful thought came into my head that every single passenger on this plane was going to one day die. And there were a few reasons, actually, when I think back that I was thinking about my own mortality at that time. In the preceding years, my sister had been diagnosed with breast cancer. Then I lost my dad. Then we had the pandemic. So I think all of us were thinking about death. And then I myself was diagnosed with breast cancer. My sister and I are both fine now, but I think even just being in my 50s means that I'm thinking about my own mortality more than normal. So I was looking about at the other passengers and I was thinking, will you be the one who makes it to 100 and dies peacefully in your sleep? Or will you be the one whose life is unexpectedly cut short? And that's when it occurred to me that in 100 years' time, somebody would be able to look back and look at all the names of the passengers on that flight, and they'd be able to look up exactly how and when each of us died. So that information would one day be available. And it sort of blew my mind for some reason, thinking those would one day be facts. And that's when I thought, what if that information was available right now and somebody stood up and, as you said, began handing out predictions?
Wow. I love how your brain works. I mean, talk about not having a book with you, because you did have a book with you. It was just in your head being born at that moment. I love that. So question, would you want to know, like, if you had the choice, this is something I was talking about with your publicist when they shared the book with me. I started reading it on a plane because I was on a plane on the way to Brazil to visit my family. And I am team, I would want a prediction, even knowing the end, which I'm not going to ruin for listeners.
I'm with you. I would want the prediction. And I know, just talking to people after the book's come out, I've come to realize that some people actually put in that situation if they have a genetic disorder in their family and they're offered genetic testing. So I had not thought of that. If I'd thought of it before, I might have put something in the book about that. But so that's the reality for some people. And if that was the case for me, I would definitely want to know. I think if there's information available, and probably why my thoughts started turning that way, if information is available, I want that information. I can't stand there being a secret and me not knowing it. So yeah, I'm with you.
100%. Like, we're curious people. Like, we must know.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, so that was the germ of the idea. And did you always know? So for our listeners who haven't read the book yet, what are you doing? Go get the book and read it now. But like, if you haven't read the book, you have the psychic's point of view in first person. And then you have three passengers that received predictions in third person. And you also have, like, most of your books have this, but like a little bit of an omniscient, like, it starts off with almost like an omniscient prologue.
Yes.
And you have like that Greek chorus vibe to it, which again, you always do so well. Did you always know that was the structure, or did you have to like add characters, remove characters? How far apart from your first draft is this final version?
So I'm not a writer who has multiple drafts, because I'm always rewriting as I go. So I sit down and pretend as if I'm just writing from start to finish. But of course, in the end, I'm always editing what I wrote yesterday and I'm switching things around, but I'm not somebody who writes one full draft and then says, okay, now I have a go at doing my second draft. I'm just going back and forth. So I had no idea about the structure. I had no idea about who was on the plane, who the characters would be, and I had no idea of what the consequences of her handing out these predictions would be.
So you're a pantser, not a plotter. Like, you write to figure it out. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. My sister, who's also an author, is a planner, and we've both tried each other's way of writing, and we're both mystified as how the other one does it.
Don't you have two sisters who are writers? I feel like I know, like, Nicola and then Jacqueline, right? Or no?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Nicola, I think, might be a little bit in the middle of us both, a little bit of planning and a little bit of pantsing. But yeah, my sister Jackie definitely has it all set out, first of all.
And so I think something that maybe most people don't know, I didn't until I looked you up and researched you for the interview. To be clear, always been a huge fan. I researched so I would be prepared with my questions. But one thing that I didn't know, maybe other people don't, is that Jacqueline was published before you. Is that right?
She was. Yes, she definitely was. And I always say, if it wasn't for her, I would never have been published. Because when we were little, we both wanted to be writers. And then she went ahead and did it first. And I can always remember when I got that phone call saying that her first YA book had been accepted for publication. And I was really happy for her because I love her dearly, but at the same time I was sort of filled with a sense of rage, really, because she'd gone ahead and she'd achieved our childhood dream and I hadn't even given it a shot. So,
and you're the eldest, right?
Yeah, and I'm the eldest, exactly.
Yeah, I'm the eldest too. We're supposed to come first.
That's right, we are. You get your driver's license first, you get your first boyfriend or whatever. And she's lovely because she says that she thinks I still would have done it if not for her. But I really don't think I would have. I needed to see her do it first.
I love it. I love it. So one of your books, I mean, all your books, not all of them, but many of them have like sibling relationships. I'm thinking of like Apples Never Fall, and I think it's Troy and Logan. And then you have obviously Three Wishes, and we have triplets. Like, would you say that your gift for psychological acuity and just observing human interactions and distilling messy emotions from those interactions in a really like curiosity inducing way. Like, for example, you just said, I was really happy for her because I love her. And I was filled with rage. Like, we feel two things that seem contradictory at the same time as humans. And one of the things you do amazingly in your stories is distill that in a way that makes you feel for this character, but and makes them feel vulnerable and real and quirky and unusual and unique. Like, where do you think that comes from?
I don't know where it comes from. I guess sometimes people have asked, do you think growing up in a big family contributed in any way to your writing? And I do sometimes think about the fact that I was always interested in our different personalities, in the fact that even though we were all siblings and all having the same childhood, we were all so different, and we all sort of enjoyed each other's differences and pointed out each other's differences and said, you know, so-and-so is the practical one or the one who gets up early, and so-and-so is the one who is good at this or good at that. And I always loved that. So maybe that gave me an appreciation of people's different personalities.
It's definitely in your novels, because I feel like as human beings, when we have, like when you have a group of anything, a group of sisters, a group of students, people often get labeled, like you said, the smart one, the one who gets up early, the one who likes cats. And oftentimes we're all the one who whatever, right? Like there's a limiting trait to labels, but at the same time we do it. And how much of labels make us who we are, how much of labels are because of who we are, like that interesting human conundrum that, you know, we'll never answer, but does infuse fiction and does make writing so special. Do you do it consciously, I guess is my question, or are you just like naturally good at that?
I don't think I do it consciously. I think it's just something that interests me. And yes, exactly as you say, that the labels can be limiting. So it's interesting that the person who always thought they were not the practical one who finds, actually, I can do this sort of stuff. Yeah, I just think that part of the writing process comes easily to me, whereas other parts do not. So, for example, describing a landscape, I find that very hard. And just describing, even I'm looking around the room that I'm in at the moment, so I'm in a hotel room. If I walked out of this room, I would not be the one who could remember things about it. Whereas personalities that I've met, I can easily describe a personality of somebody that I've met. So sometimes I feel when I'm writing those parts, I almost have to fake it. And I don't know why I say fake it. It feels like it's faking it because it doesn't come as easily.
Yeah, but it's definitely not faking it.
No, it's not faking it, but I don't know why it doesn't flow. So I might have to do something where I might have to look up a hotel room and see it in front of me, if you know what I mean. I'd have to look up a picture and just write down everything that I see.
It's acquired as opposed to innate.
That's the way to put it. Thank you. That's the way I'll say it going forward. Yeah.
No, but I like that. And do you have any resources? Like, so our listeners are obviously like writers, and you know, some people use Scrivener, some people swear by emotional thesaurus. Like, do you have any writing resources, writing go-to tools that you love?
So did you say an emotional thesaurus? Is that a thing?
Yes, it's a thing. So it's like a thesaurus, but with emotions in it. And you, I mean, Leon, you don't need it. Come on, you could write the emotional thesaurus. Like, It's a thing.
Oh, that's so interesting to me. The only things I have, which I've seen a lot of in the acknowledgements of people's books, I have the program that stops the internet for me. So I have the one called Freedom. Although I thought it was stopping access to my email, and then I realized it wasn't. And as soon as I knew it wasn't, then that meant I could check my email. Anyway, what I do is you can put in how many minutes that you can't have internet access for. And in a way, that always felt like I was programming myself to write for that period of time. So if I say 2 hours, that means I'm going to write for the next 2 hours. But apart from that, the only thing is the wonder of the internet, where if you're describing a fire, for example, you can look up a fire, you can see it happening, you can see a YouTube video, then you can also look up on Reddit or whatever. So I've got a civil engineer in this latest book, and I was just Googling what's the worst thing about being a civil engineer, and there it is all, that's right there for you, discussion boards of people talking about their frustrations. So I love the internet, but of course I also hate it because you can then spend entire days reading what civil engineers hate about their jobs.
Yes, and it's very messy, like messy human emotions. Like we love it, we hate it.
Yes.
I feel like I can definitely tell that there's like as a pure reader and fan and admirer of your work, I can definitely tell that there's like a deep curiosity that runs inside of you, just interested in human things, human condition, personalities. And at the same time, I see a lot in your work, and I'll give you examples from this book that, in my opinion, probably requires research, like things like the Monte Carlo fallacy and Gödel's incompleteness theorem. You know, like, is that Google? Like, do you spend lots of time Googling? Do you talk to people? I guess I do know you talk to some people because I have noticed it in the acknowledgments of your book. But like, how do you go about researching the one line? Okay, one line's an exaggeration, but like it's a paragraph that makes it into the novel. But I know that you probably spend a lot more time researching that, right? Like, how does that process work?
So I just research as I go. And yeah, there is Googling. There's also, I buy lots of books, which I don't necessarily read them all. So in this case, I bought books on tarot card readings, on clairvoyance, and I also read books about randomness and some which were actually way above my head, but that I could pull out enough to, again, it feels like that faking it. So it's not faking. I always feel like I'm getting away with it. What did you say before? Acquiring it. So I'm inquiring.
Acquired, not innate. Yeah. You know what this is, right? This is the patriarchy in your head, because women feel like we're faking it. We're not faking it. We're doing the work. It's just if something doesn't come 100% naturally to us, we're like, oh my God, I'm faking it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? You're absolutely right. I'm sure it is. And then, as you say, I talk to people. And because I'm not a planner, the research will then drive the novel. So, for example, with Apples Never Fall, I originally just had the premise of if you thought your father had murdered your mother and how that would make you look at their marriage and how siblings might respond differently. And I remember I was thinking I should give them a family business, really just so I could keep them all in one place, because it's annoying when your characters have to go off to work.
But then tennis became a character. That's what I love about
exactly.
that novel.
Exactly. Like
sport
yes.
is a character. Yeah.
That's right. So, yeah, so then I thought I'll have it as a tennis school. But then the thing was, then I thought, well, and so I just thought I could just put that in the background. But then I thought, but the thing is, if they're running a tennis school, I guess they're really into tennis. So now I'm going to have to talk to tennis players. And then little things that these tennis players I talked to said to me, they then help drive the plot of the story.
Interesting. So I'm really curious to know how you work out your endings. And I definitely don't want to share spoilers in this book. You've gotten very well deserved a lot of praise for Here One Moment. I haven't actually said the title of the book, and I apologize. Listeners, it's called Here One Moment by Leon Moriarty. You guys probably already know this, though. Let's face it, it's Leon Moriarty. You are, like me, huge fans. But I feel like there's a lot of people saying amazing things. And one of my favorites is USA Today called it like drinking a pink Cosmo laced with arsenic, which, let's face it, is a great line. But my favorite of all was actually an Anne Lamott blurb, because she wrote, "A riveting story so wild, you don't know how she'll land it." And then she does, on a dime. And I'll tell you, I read this book before reading any blurbs, because like the copy I had didn't have anything. I now have a finished copy. And as I was reading it, I was also like, where's she going with this? Because like we're following these people, and it wasn't a where is she going, like I didn't have any theories. It was more of a, it wasn't confusion, it was curiosity, but also like I was afraid at one point, because I was, how is she going to close this? Because we were nearing the end, and I know you close books, like you always close your books in a very satisfying way. And I was like, how is she going to do it? Because either this one thing's going to happen with this other thing and I'm not going to ruin, and neither of them are going to work. And of course you did a third thing. Like it wasn't A or B, it was C. Did you know the ending, or did you like figure it out as you went along? Like for this book, for your other books, like how do endings work for you?
So I always figure out as I go along. So which is, for me, it's a fun way to write, because I sit down and I think, I wonder what's going to happen today. But then it's also a scary way to write, because you think, I hope something happens today. And it just means that I'm always thinking, maybe this will happen, maybe that will happen. I'm always just throwing about, sort of brainstorming with myself. So I never want aspiring authors to ever think that I'm saying that it all falls perfectly into place. It doesn't. It's just as I'm going, little things are happening that I think, well, maybe that could lead to this. And probably about two-thirds of the way through the book, there's this wonderful moment where I can see, okay, this is going to work. And I love that moment. And then what I have to do, once I know how it's going to end, then it means I can then go back and I can put in red herrings, or there are some things that I need to fix. So I always have a separate document called Things I Need to Fix, because once I've worked it out, I know. So for example, again, with Apples Never Fall, it became important that Stan would not own a cell phone. But then I suddenly remembered in the first chapter that I'd written, I have him in bed scrolling on his phone. So the first thing on my list of things I need to fix was take Stan's phone away from him. So they're just little things that I need to remind myself to fix, but I'm too caught up in the story to do it right away.
I love that. So we on the podcast call them, like, these things you're, well, some of these things you're referring to, curiosity seeds, strategically placed morsels of information that keep the reader turning the page in a way that makes them really curious. Like, it's a self-explanatory name. And I've always wondered, like, do you go back and plant your curiosity seeds? I love knowing that you do. I love knowing that because it feels so organic. It feels so natural to the story.
Well, it's great when it happens accidentally, so it is organic. Yeah, so I love it when I don't need to go back and plant them, because then you do feel sometimes like you have to shoehorn them in. So the best ones are when it's a happy accident, and then you think, oh, this could actually mean this. But either way, to the reader, they probably don't know that.
They feel the same, 100%. Like, you know, because you're the author, you're the creator of the story, the God that built the world. But we, you know, we're mere mortals, just like taking it all in. So, okay, speaking of best and worst, and so I fell in love and I discovered you many, many, many years ago, different life. I remember this. I remember I was in New York. I bought your book. I opened it, I started reading it. It was The Husband's Secret. And that was your breakout book. That was the book that propelled you into success. And then I read all your other books that came before that. And then I started reading all the new books as soon as they came out. I guess my question is, your fans have favorites. Do you have favorites? Can you tell us which one, or do you not want to?
I always tend to think that my most recent one is a favorite because the characters are still so clear in my head. So in this case, I still feel so fondly of Cherry. And that's why when I start writing a new book, I always miss the characters from my previous book, because by the end of the book, you know the characters and they come so easily to you. So when I start writing a new one, the characters feel all cardboard-like, and I think, I want to go back to Napoleon from Nine Perfect Strangers. I know what he'd say. And also, I'm always trying to get better. So I feel like this is my best novel, but I know readers, for whatever reason, something, they connect with something, so there'll be one that is their particular favorite because something resonates, or because, I don't know, it reminds them of a lovely holiday, or it got them through a bad time, or whatever.
Yeah, well, how someone feels about a book has as much to do with themselves as it does with the book, and I realize that's true of other storytelling forms as well. But when we all watch a TV show, we're all seeing the same thing. Like, the dress is red. Do you know what I'm saying? But when we read a book, we're all imagining different things. Like, Allegra's face in my head is different from Allegra's face in my sister's head. And we're reading the same book. So I feel like that's why people feel so strongly and they have like diehard favorites, because it's all their imagination that's leveraging the story.
I always find that so interesting, because sometimes people come up to me at events and they say something about the book and it's slightly wrong. And I know it's wrong because I wrote the book, but I realized that they're taking something from their own life that they've sort of projected onto the book. So they're seeing something, if there's a beach or something, that it's a childhood beach. So, and I love that every single experience, exactly as you say, is slightly different, but it's my imagination working with your imagination and together creating
fusion,
all these little
worlds.
It's
cerebral fusion.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Gosh, that is a lovely phrase. Yes,
it's
that's
true,
exactly
though,
what it is.
Isn't it? Like, it's cerebral and creative fusion. It's the one thing that brings two minds together. It's very, it's magic.
I remember my son, when he was really little, sort of being amazed when he first started reading and saying to me, so a book is like there's a movie playing in your head, isn't it? And it was so lovely.
I love that. That's such a beautiful line. Oh my gosh. So like I said, when I introduced you, you're a publishing phenomenon. You are so many people's number one authors, including mine. I guess my question to you is, looking back at your career, now that you're a superstar author, how are things different from, you know, your first book, and how are they the same? I mean, assuming some things even still are the same.
I think in many ways, it's still the same. I still seem to flail about a lot at the beginning of a novel. I still don't sit down to write with total confidence. I'm still in the early days of a novel. I have to make myself double click on that document. I'm almost scared to sit down and write, and I'm thinking I can't do it until there's enough of the story there that it feels like there's something tangible and it has momentum. And then I get over that fear of opening the document, which is, I know, sounds so weird, but yeah, I still have that. Yeah, I still have that same process, even though I've tried, as I said, I've tried the planning. Anne Tyler is my favorite author, and I read that she puts different scenes on index cards. So I always remember buying a whole lot of index cards and then not really knowing what to do with them. So I still buy a beautiful new notepad with each new book and write notes in it, but then really that doesn't mean anything. I just normally end up thinking I've just got to sit down and start typing. The only thing I think sometimes there's a bit more fear, because with the earlier books, I hope they'd be published. And with the very first book, obviously that was my dream, that it would be published. But even with the earlier books where they were selling, and they were selling well enough that that was my job, but now it feels quite different in that I know for a fact that people will read it and people will have opinions on it. So it feels more public or something. There's a slightly different feeling, and sometimes maybe I miss the freedom of, especially of the first book, where you're not thinking, which is the way you should write, not imagining, was certainly not imagining critical voices, which is something that I've got to put out of my mind. They disappear once the story takes hold, and because then I'm too interested in the characters, so it's a relief when they're quiet.
How long does that take you? Like, how long does it take you to write a book, and how far into the process do you usually have to be before you feel that confidence kicking in? I know the fear never totally goes away, but...
No. I think, yeah, it's always hard for me to say how long does it really take, because I don't know how much time I literally spent at my desk, and I'm always really interested in how long could I do it if I did nothing else. I'm always amazed at how quickly some people can write a novel. It seems to me to take 1 to 2 years. And I guess at that lovely momentum stage is maybe 3 or 4 months into it. So, and sometimes it happens quicker. So Big Little Lies came together very quickly. And I always think my children were quite little then. I didn't have much time. And maybe that helped, because I had no choice but work in the precious time I had available.
That's super interesting to know. And I feel like it takes you however long it's going to take you, right? For each different author, that's just, you know, there's no sense in comparing. But I know our listeners are really interested in knowing things like timing, because sometimes they'll take years to write a novel. And I tell them, like, that's normal, because whatever your timing is normal. That's just how it works. So talk to me about multi-POV. Like, I don't think you've ever written a single point of view novel. There are novels where it's heavier on one point of view, like the hypnotist's love story. Maybe I'm wrong, but I can't remember a single one that's like single point of view. Would you ever write a single point of view novel?
Well, it's so interesting you say that, because I just did an event recently with the wonderful Karen Joy Fowler, who I'm a big fan of. And I was saying that I always say that my next novel is going to be a single point of view, a first person, because I know sometimes that I annoy readers by having too many characters in my novels.
No, you don't annoy us.
Some people do. I know some people do because they say I can't keep up with all the different characters. And so I can remember.
Who are these people? I have to talk to them. Send them to talk to me. Be like, talk to Cece.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah. I will. And so then I think, okay, there's only not going to be many characters. And then I have 9 perfect strangers. So there are at least 9. And then I have this book when I suddenly have a plane load of passengers. And Karen said, I think she was quoting somebody else, but she was saying something along the lines of that she thinks every author has a desire to write the novel they're incapable of writing. And so, yeah, maybe that's, and I think she's probably right, that that might be the case for me, that no matter how many times I try, I just love multiple perspectives so much that I'll probably start writing.
You do it so well.
Oh, thank you. I think every time I think I'll stay with this character, I can't resist suddenly being able to see that character from somebody else's point of view. It's such fun.
Oh, I love that. I love the idea that, because I always think of multi-POV as like necessary for tension, because then you know like who's keeping what secret. But like you're so right. We also get to see the protagonist or one of the protagonists through another person's eyes. That's really interesting. How do you get into their heads? Like, I feel like this might be something just that you're just naturally good at, but you have really different characters. And of course, you research and give them different jobs and different aspirations. But like Allegra wanting to be a pilot, how did that happen?
I'm trying to think. There was just a little story that a family member said that she was trying to think of what she would do if she was going in some other profession. And then her family said to her, what would you do if you could do anything? And she said, well, I'd be a nurse. And they all just looked at her and said, well, why don't you be a nurse? It was funny that for whatever reason, she hadn't thought of that. So it's little stories like that, that I just, for some reason, I was really taken with that story. So I gave a similar sort of story to the character of Allegra, that for whatever reason, if she was asked that question, she would have said pilot, but didn't think that was possible for her. But I don't know. Again, I don't know how I get into their heads. It's by just thinking about them and sometimes thinking of a few character attributes I might take from people I know, but never a whole personality.
It's like a gateway drug, but it's not a drug. Like it's like a gateway to your character.
Yeah, my way in, is something often from real life, but they're never that person in the end.
Love that. Speaking of way in, do you often change the beginning of your story or do you usually like know when it begins? Like, are you the kind of person who adds new chapters to be chapter one or do you usually know?
I usually know, but sometimes I might think I need to go back a bit further or to jump forward and then go back. But I like to imagine that I'm writing it just from start to finish. So I've got my document with the things I need to fix with little things, but I prefer not to be making big structural changes at the end. I like to pretend that when I'm writing the last sentence, and I always type out the end, even though they never actually have the end in the novel, I want that to really be the end. So I don't allow myself to write the last few paragraphs until I've finished my things I need to fix document and until I've got the structure as I want it.
For sure. And okay, so let's talk publishing as opposed to writing. One of the things that kind of drives our listeners a little bananas and fair listeners are genres, right? Like what genre is XYZ? Like how would you define the genre you write in and has that changed over time?
Yeah, I find it very difficult to define my genre and people want to know. So people ask, you know, if I say I'm a writer and they say, what sort of books do you write? I always struggle to answer. I can always remember one at an airport, what are they called? The
Like the customs, yeah?
Yeah, customs. Yeah. It is customs, yeah.
Customs and Border Patrol, yeah.
Yeah, yes, yes, those people. And, you know, they're slightly terrifying. And so, and they say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a writer. And then they say, what sort of books? And I think as if, and I'm just fumbling to answer. So in the end, I sort of say family dramas. I would prefer them not to be described as thrillers, because I think they're not thrilling enough to be thrillers. And then I think that true thriller readers then get a bit impatient because they're more plot driven. But I guess some of my books have gone a little bit that way. What do you think? What would you describe them?
I think you write book club fiction, if I had to give like a dry answer. But if I were you at Customs and Border Patrol and someone asked me that, I would be like, at Customs and Border Patrol, I would carry a microphone in my hand and I would say, number one New York Times bestselling books. That's the kind of books I write. And then I drop the mic, making a big thud, you know, in a scene. That's what I would do.
They tend not to be readers. So I don't think that.
Go to the airport store, sir. Go there, sir. Maybe read something. Do you want my autograph? Like, I would totally do that. I'd be insufferable. So as a literary agent, I hype my clients' books, right? Like, I'm always talking about my clients' books and how much I love my clients. And like, my own clients have told me, they're like, Cece, like, no one loves their own books that much. Like, and I'm like, of course you don't love your own books that much, but your fans do. I'm your number one fan. That's what an agent is, your first fan. So you got to let me be.
You sound like you're a wonderful agent, Cece.
Oh gosh, I love what I do, Leon. I'll tell you that. Like, I love what I do. I love being a first reader. And I guess that's my question to you. Do you have a first reader? Like, do you always have one person who's always your first reader, or does that change?
So I tend to just submit it to my editors, but I do send it to my sisters at the same time. But there's not enough time for them to really give any feedback. So they know that their job is just to say good things as fast as possible. So, because as you know, every author is desperate for feedback within minutes of sending it. And so, yeah, so it's just to send a text within as short a time as possible to say, this is a masterpiece, you know, or something similar.
I love that. I love that. So you just confirmed my theory. My theory in life is that it doesn't matter how famous you are, how talented, how many accolades or awards and validation you've received, objective validation, stuff like number one New York Times bestseller. At the end of the day, every author wants to hear that someone loves this book. Right? So that's true of you. That's true of everyone. I love that. Is there any chance that you'll ever write a memoir someday or a craft book for your fans? Or are you like, no, that sounds so boring, I want to stick with my novels?
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't write a memoir. Nothing interesting enough has happened. And also, I have a terrible memory.
You do? I'm very surprised.
No, I'm not good. And which is why I'm really grateful for being part of a big family, because often they can tell me stories from, and I think, oh, I totally forgot that. So yeah, I don't have a good memory, and I'm not, you know, I wouldn't want to write a crafty book. But the two books I always recommend are Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott and Stephen King's On Writing. And I think, yeah, I think both of them say, yeah, I feel like I've got nothing to add. So when people ask for writing tips, I just fumble around a lot. And then finally I say, read those.
Interesting. Okay. So that's so surprising to hear, because, I mean, I'm asking you if you would write books and you're like, oh, I still refer to them. But that's good. You're a lifelong learner, right? Like, that's good.
Oh, yes. I'm interested in reading how other authors do things. Yeah, I find my process is too fumbly. Yeah.
I don't think it's fumbly at all, but I think it's organic, and I get what you're saying, because it's not like I use this software and this software will change your life.
Yes.
On that note, what advice would you give our listeners? Like, they are listening to you, they are thinking, oh my God, I hope to one day be, you know, even in the same league as Leon Moriarty. What advice would you give to aspiring authors who are now where you were before your debut?
Well, first of all, it depends on whether they're at a point where they're having trouble writing. And I think there are a lot of people who dream of writing and then spend a lot of time thinking about writing and listening to podcasts and going to writers' festivals without actually writing, which I totally understand that terror of opening the document and getting started. And the only way to do it is to do it. The one thing I do is, apart from my turning off the internet, I also have an hourglass which goes for 20 minutes. And so I often say, okay, you've just got to write for 20 minutes without a single stopping to revise or a single stopping to think about what you're writing. So just write anything at all for 20 minutes and you'll be surprised how that can take you into something. That's my one little thing. Stop going to the writers' festivals. I shouldn't say stop listening to the podcast. And you can keep listening to this podcast.
It's okay. It's okay if you also need to stop, listeners. We want you to succeed, first and foremost.
Yeah, well, listen to this one, but then go and write for 20 minutes without thinking of anything else. Just write the way you probably did write when you were a child. And, yeah, let it take you away.
Write in the way that you used to write when you were a child. That is perfect advice. I love that so much, so much. Thank you so much. So for our last question, and I ask this of every guest, would you please recommend us a book? It can be a book that you are excited to read but haven't read yet, or one that you have read and loved, or anything else. We really like to elevate authors and promote authors. You know, we believe that books are empathy generating machines that can have the power to change the world and bring connection in a world that desperately needs connection. So we want to showcase authors. Leon Moriarty, what book would you recommend our listeners read?
So I loved recently In Memoriam by Alice Wynn. Am I allowed more than one? I'm also excited about Anne Tyler has a new book coming out. She's my favorite author, and I heard somebody told me just the other day, I didn't know that apparently there's a new book of hers coming out next year, so I'm excited about that. And my sister, Jacqueline Moriarty, I've read her manuscript of an incredible time travel book, which does not yet have a title, but I know is going to be incredible. So you heard that here first.
Oh, I really want to read that. Time travel, like Time Traveler's Wife time travel, or like more, because she doesn't write sci-fi.
It's about a time travel agency where you can go and time travel. I know, it's going to be wonderful.
That sounds amazing. Okay, now my TBR has just grown and grown, and that's great because it's a great problem to have. Leon, thank you so much. Thank you for making my whole year with this interview and joining us and being so fabulous and for writing the very best books in the world. You were so generous recommending all the books. And listeners, I'm pretty sure you've all picked up her book already, but if you haven't, it's called Here One Moment. You know, my favorite Leon Moriarty book used to be The Husband's Secret. Now that has been debunked to number two. Sorry, The Husband's Secret. Sorry, Cecilia, that's the protagonist. It's now Here One Moment because it really does, it does deliver on all the things. It gives you that propulsive plot, those unforgettable characters, and it changes you on the inside. It makes you look at your life and go, oh, wait, whoa. And that's amazing. So thank you.
Oh my goodness, Ceci. Thank you so much. That all means so much to me. And this has been such a pleasure.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Ceci Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Ceci on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine deck and deck of worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.